primary focus on our international relations is going to be on China and Chinese communism, although we're going to go all over the place in things we talk about. The primary reason, really two primary reasons why we're taking that kind of focus is, number one, Mao's version of communism is a kind of communism that has really caught not only in China and the Orient, but also in the Western world, with the result that today there are probably more than a billion people that are reading and familiar with this book, and there's no other book around, including the Bible, that has that many readers today. So I'm going to introduce you to a bit of that. Our general context is the concern about the future of the church and the church's welfare. And in order to talk about that, we've got to give you some theoretic foundation and theoretic background. This is a little bit difficult. I realize that with this outstanding intellectual audience here, it'll be relatively easy. But Americans, for some reason or other, are kind of anti-philosophic. They're not particularly interested in philosophy. They want to get down to nuts and bolts issues and solve them. And yet, in dealing with communism, you have to get into philosophy. And so we're going to do some philosophy today, but we'll try to do it in a relatively painless kind of fashion. We won't give you acupuncture, but we'll try to do it in a way that things become clear. My colleague to the left here is Dr. Hennig Falkenstein. We will call him Hennig for obvious reasons. I'm Dr. William Lehman, and we will call me Bill also for obvious reasons. Because a relaxed, informal setting around a fireplace doesn't call for Dr. this and Dr. that. But at any rate, Hennig's specialty is in continental literature. And my specialty is philosophy, particularly political philosophy and ethics. And that's why we're here. I'll do most of the talking in the preliminary session this morning. We'll toss it back and forth next time and the final period. Today what we're going to try to do is set forth basic communist theory and how it relates to the church. Next time we will talk, Wednesday, we will talk about the strategy for the overthrow of non-communist forms of society and governments, and how it has been tried in various places in the world, particularly in Western Europe. And finally, on Thursday, we will talk about the future strategy and role of the church in the world, Christian church in the world, with particular emphasis upon mainland China. Most of you people are Air Force or Air Force related, and I'm sure you realize that when the Air Force plans an operation, they have briefing sessions and backgrounding material, and they get experts in who talk on the enemy and what the enemy's strengths and weaknesses are and so on. In a sense, that's what Hennig and I are doing first couple of days, because the strategy is going to come out on the third day. That's what we're going to do as a Christian church. And so we're briefing you. You people are the church, and we're going to work together on what we're going to do and what our future role is in the world. I should comment that Hennig and I were inducted into the Air Force this morning as witness our badges. We were the first two civilians to get badges. Paul Rigg inducted us. He told us that for the first 3 years we would be non-coms, and he made no commitment beyond that, but he said we would be taken care of and not to worry. So, consider us one of you, at least for the next 3 days. Okay, this is a visual aid. You must forget that it is a collection basket for purposes of this morning. It helps philosophy to work with visual aids And I am now desanctifying it till the end of the period. I promised Werner that I would re-sanctify it and put it back in the sacristy so it could be used tonight or whenever a first collection is going to be. But at any rate, for purposes of this morning, this will be the Wheel of History, communist version. That's why I desanctified it. So if you see it getting red or anything like that, let me know. We'll dip it in Railroad Creek or something like that to clean it up. Okay, now, the basic principle of dialectical materialism, or economic materialism as Marx called it, is that the way that the economy in a particular area of the world is structured, the way production occurs, and the directions that the products of economic activity go determines the kind of society. In other words, economics creates society. The first principle of organization is economics. Consequently, if you want to change a society, you affect its economy, and in that way, you change its society. The type of society which one has determines the kind of arts which are produced by that society, kind of literature, the kind of philosophy, and whether or not there is a religion and the kind of religion that it has. Consequently, for the thing that we're primarily concerned about these days, according to communist theory, religion is an artifact of a given kind of society. It is a product of that kind of society, and it is meaningful only in relation to that society. It is not exportable into another culture and another kind of society. Now, religion and the arts, history, all of these are used in a given society to reinforce the prevailing values, to defend them, to justify them, and as best as possible to retain them. Consequently, particularly in the case of religion, religion is used, according to communist theory, in order to put people to sleep about inequities and problems which are in the society, and so it functions as a kind of an opiate. It does not exist apart from a society. It has no non-cultural value or non-cultural role. It is part of the society to hold the society together and to retain that particular kind of society. Now, if something happens to the economy, this will have an effect upon the society, upon the social structure, and in turn then it will have an effect upon the religion, the arts, the literature, the history, what is taken as having been the case. History is caused by struggle of one class against another. If there were no class struggle, there would be no history. Class struggle, classes are elements of society, they're parts of society, so obviously they're brought into existence because of certain economic forces. They are forces of inequity. Now, how did history come into being? There's such a thing as prehistory. Prehistory is when there wasn't anything happening, where one day was like the next. History began when the first man took something from the commonality of nature and said, "This is mine." He thereby had set himself in a class apart from the rest. He had become a landowner, or he'd become a private property owner. Nobody else was. And so consequently, history begins with this, and we now have up on top the farmer. And for Marx, the farmer epic is the first epic, where you have individual human beings taking certain areas of the world as theirs, taking them out of the public domain, taking it into the private domain. Now, quite obviously, they have any intelligence at all. These kind of people have an advantage over the other people that are still foraging around in the wilderness, hoping to run across nuts or other sorts of things that they can survive on. Because these people are beginning to domesticate and do other sorts of things like this, and their life is much more secure. Now, as a result of this, we get the beginning of history, and our wheel is now set to roll. We have created the first set of classes, the propertied, the non-property. The propertied people are the guys on top, the non-propertied are the guys on the bottom. Somewhere along the line, somebody got the bright idea that if he got together with a female farmer and they produced some farmerettes, that they could handle a lot more acreage than the ones that were going it on their own. And so we get the family unit occurring, and in very rapid order, a revolution takes place. You see the revolution? It went around. That's a revolution. And now we get the families up on top and the bachelors and bachelorettes on the bottom. Because the families now can run rings around the bachelors and the bachelorettes. They're organized and the other ones aren't. So now we have the familial and the non-familial structure, and this is our second epic. And so on, we can trace it through. As time goes on and we get more families beginning to emerge, what begins to happen? You get families like the Corleone family coming along and offering people contracts that they can't turn down. Well, when you get these kind of families beginning to get in the various families of mankind, people start getting together for protection. And you form the tribe. And so now the tribe has an advantage over the people that are going it themselves. And so we go through a series of these epics. The next one which comes along is the town. The one after this is the city, which Marx models after Rome. Then comes feudalism, as the vast numbers of uncivilized overthrow the tiny, decadent, civilized Rome, and over it goes. And then we go into the Middle Ages, and from the Middle Ages we get the emergence of the middle class through the guilds, and then we get the age of the bourgeoisie, which has several subdivisions, but it's generally referred to as the age of capitalism, in which two-fifths of the world is, and the other three-fifths, at least theoretically, is past that into communism. All right, now, we've got to talk a little, in quotation marks, physics to understand why this happens. So we now will get into the science of communism. This is revolution, see, and so physical revolution, so we have to talk physics. Momentum is caused by two principles. This wheel is caused to turn by two principles, an active principle and a neutral principle. The active principle is the number of people that are here and that are here. The other principle is the principle of economic resources or capital or wealth or whatever you want to call it. Now, this is a kind of a weight. What it tends to do is to drift upward. But when you get a small number of people here and an increasingly large amount of wealth here, what tends to happen is the wheel flips over, you have a revolution, and you move into the next epoch. Now, what causes the wheel to turn around is this. You get antagonisms which begin to build. Mao calls them contradictions. But you get antagonisms which begin to build. As the people up on top oppress the people down on the bottom, as more and more wealth and power flows to them, and in competition with one another, they get smaller and smaller, and people drift down to the bottom class here and get to be more and more. You get an increasing number of dissatisfied people
who devote all of their energies to turning the thing around this way so they're on top. At the same time, you have the people that are right here on top that use all their energies to keep the wheel from turning this way or that way. And you've got a certain number of people who were on top on the last one who are trying to turn the wheel backwards. They're the reactionaries. So you have the people on the bottom trying to move the wheel this way. They're the progressives. People that are on top trying to keep it right where it is because they're top dogs, and those are the status quo people. And you got people over here that used to be in power and aren't anymore, and they're trying to turn it back, and those are the reactionaries. And so in any particular epoch, you will find these three forces at work on the wheel trying to shift the wheel the way they want it. And every time the wheel makes a revolution, you've got a new epoch. Now, each one of these revolutions occurs with a certain amount of trauma, obviously. The guys that were up on top are now on the bottom. Their wealth drifts up this way to the guys that are on top, either by liberation, which all of us that went through World War II know about, or by the change of the economy, which causes these people to lose their wealth in one way or another and these people to get it. But each one of these occurs as a revolution. Now bear in mind, the revolution began when the first guy created private property. Before that, there was no revolution. There was no history. And ever since then, it's been the wheel turn. Well, this leads for a very unstable life, doesn't it? You can never be sure about the economy. You can never be sure about your welfare. So the problem is going to be, how can we stop the wheel from turning? And the solution will be, very obviously, you get rid of the cause of the wheel to turn. What causes the wheel to turn? The fact that you got this class oppressing this class, you got class antagonisms, you get rid of classes, and private property, which started the whole mess. So you get rid of these two things, and the wheel will stay still, and everybody's going to be like everybody else, and we'll just all get along fine. Now, that's a kind of an oversimplified version of Marxian communism. The problem now is, how are you going to stop the wheel? And can you stop the wheel? Or are there certain kinds of reasons why people naturally do take things and make them their own? There is this private property, a natural psychological need for people. Are people willing to live under the kind of conditions whereby they get a stabilized kind of world? Would that world be utterly dull and lacking in novelty? So there are all sorts of questions that get involved here. So much for the wheel. We'll return it to its collection purposes. Notice I very carefully refrained from referring to the fact that that had an economic role in life. Okay. People are energized by frictions against one another to move into new kinds of relationships, and I talked about that. One other principle, every movement of the wheel tends to generate its opposite. This is the dialectical principle. When a new group comes into ascendancy on the top, it, over a period of time, tends to create its own opposition. It tends to generate antagonisms. When a class of people deals with another class of people and it is in a superior role to it, it tends to generate antagonism. This is inevitable. This is a fact of life, according to Marx. All right, now we are at international capitalism, which was initiated by the Industrial Revolution. The unique genius of the Industrial Revolution was that it socialized workers, which is another way for saying somebody invented a factory. You organized a society of workers within a given building or set of buildings to produce a product. It wasn't every man for himself, but you socialized a group of workers, and they produced products. What happened to the products when they came out of the factory? They belonged to somebody else. So you separated the worker from his product. And this produced the first contradiction and the first problem. And he created thereby the problem of who owns what. Now, when you are running an agricultural kind of society where every guy's got his farm, there's no question about who owns what, is there? And if one guy is lazy and sits on his duff and watches the Watergate trials while the other guy's out planting his seed and killing the weeds and everything else, and the one guy gets a small yield and the other guy gets a big yield, well, the guy that got the big yield, that's his. Why? Because he can point out the geographic boundaries of his farm, and the next guy sees the geographic boundaries of his farm, and, you know, it's all fairly clear who owns what. But when you create a factory for making cars and you got 10,000 people doing things, who owns the car when it comes out? Or if you say it belongs to all the workers who produced it, how much? I put the little emblem on the front of the grill in front of the radiator. How much of the car belongs to me? How much of its value belongs to me? See, as opposed to the guy that put the right front tire on. All of a sudden, we've got some very sticky problems about who owns what that never existed before. That's just one. So the first problem which comes into being with capitalism is, on the one end, we've socialized production so that nobody can say, the product's mine. And what happens at the end of the line is the product goes to somebody else, the guy who owns the company. Or to make it even more complex, if it's a corporation, you know, the corporation owns the end products until they dispose of them, and if I'm a stockholder, how much of it do I own? You know, if I hold Ford Motor Company stock, do I go to Willow Run and say, I like that fourth car back there, I'm a stockholder, and drive off with it? Well, you try that only once. So the whole business of who gets what gets extremely messy. This is why we have strikes. This strike is an evidence that we don't really know who gets what. And so we antagonize one another as we work out a conventional agreement on which both sides kind of begrudgingly are willing to live. Well, that's one of the problems. Second kind of problem. We organize production in an individual workshop. We have a very complex, complicated factory where everything goes relatively smoothly when everybody knows what he's supposed to do and does it. And things just move along beautifully. What happens outside the factory? We have sheer anarchy of the marketplace. Here I am, and I'm president of Ford Motor Company, and I say, fellas, I really like that Edsel. Let's turn out 100,000 more next year. See, and then there sit my 100,000 Edsels, and nobody buys them. And every manager of a business knows what I'm talking about right now. You can organize as well as you want. You can use all of the market predictors that you want. And you keep your fingers crossed when you stock your goods. Whether you're running Holden Village Store, or, you know, whether you're running a factory or other kinds of places. You can't control the marketplace. You are subject to blind whims of the marketplace. And there are various kinds of ways you can hedge yourself. If you got a big business, if you got a small one, you're very limited. If you got a big corporation, you can run safer and safer. But even then, you're getting along just fine, and all of a sudden they devalue the dollar on you. And you're in international trade. You know, and there it's up for grabs again. Or you're in the travel business, and all of a sudden it costs twice as much or three times as much to eat a meal in Tokyo. It's chaotic. It's anarchic. Second problem, which is generated by capitalism. Third problem. The mode of production is in rebellion against the mode of exchange, says Marx. What he means by this is, it is the nature of a capitalistic enterprise to expand. It must expand or it dies.
must get bigger and bigger and bigger. Every year it must increase its revenues or its markets. And so it's expansionistic. Well, as we all know, this is a finite world. There's a limit to how big you can grow, contrary to what IT&T seems to think, or any of the other conglomerates. But there's a limit to how big you can grow, and yet you must keep expanding in order to stay alive. You can't stay the same size. There's no way you can survive, so you always got to get bigger. As a result, the bigger companies get, they've got to have room to expand. The only place they can expand eventually is to knock out other companies, wipe them out one way or another, either by merger or by bankrupting them. It doesn't take long, and the borders of your own country aren't adequate for your business. You have to go international. When you get international, then you've got to spread more and more. You're in competition on an international level. And so what tends to happen is corporations grow bigger and bigger. They tend to squeeze one another out. They tend to become supranational. And there are no kind of controls over them. They grow like cancers, including there's no control by the board of directors. Sooner or later, the corporation just simply sort of takes over. And the board of directors are there to keep feeding the animal as it keeps growing, and coming up with new ways to keep the thing alive. And so, there, on the one hand, there is this expansionism, which is essential to the life of the corporation. On the other hand, you have fluctuation of market need, with the result that when the expansion of the business gets out of sync with market needs, what happens? You get a depression. And so as a result, you start going up and down this way. See, now as you go down this way and you go into a depression, what tends to happen? There's a tendency to start in the direction of revolution, isn't there? We're going to get out of there. And we're going to change the way things are. You come out of the depression and it rights itself. Maybe it even goes a little bit back to the right wing, and then it straightens out. See, and so these kinds of dips we go through, and as we operate on a world level, we get worldwide depressions, which have a massive effect on people. Consequently, we've got to do away with this kind of an economy, says Karl Marx. What we have to do is get an economy where everybody's taken care of, where we don't superproduce what we don't need, and where people don't suffer want. In other words, we've got to get into a communist society. Now, we'll be talking next time about how we get there in more detail. And I want to talk a little bit more right now about what happens in a capitalist society as that makes it possible for the society to be changed from a capitalistic society to a non-capitalistic society. And then we'll shift over into Lenin's edition, Mao's addition to this, and then a few ideas from Mao. Let me light my cigarette and see if my colleague's got anything he wants to say at this point.
Light your cigarette, but I don't know whether I should chip in right now. We, as we said, tomorrow I'll more or less talk about the actual attempts in especially West Germany, how the communist students primarily tried to take over there. This will not be so much theory, it will be just practical experiences that I had in the period of about 3 summers, and that is quite interesting. We will need a little bit of different background there because the European situation is different, definitely, from the Chinese situation. But as far as the as Marx is concerned, I don't know whether we should add anything. Yeah, we can, you know. I might add, you know, the theory of Marx that you mentioned here is, of course, one way of interpreting history, and not the only one. You know, and Marx's theory is not only so that you would, I would say, just say that economic conditions are the predominant ones in the world. You can actually prove that in the course of history. Now, you just went over that briefly, but if you later have some question about that, you can interpret history, let's say, as the revelation of God. You can also present all of Western history as actually the revelation of the fact that economic, social structures dominate the world, starting from primitive societies where, as you said with that beautiful basket there, there is no history, it is in perfect balance, and then suddenly one thinks, why should I work? Let the other guy work. You see, and then you have a slave or a slave owner at the same time. And this, you might say, is nice theory, but how do you prove it? But Marx, however, also said you can interpret history fully in that light. For instance, you can say that the civilization of Rome and of Greece is entirely built on that particular structure. See, Rome would never have flourished without slaves, Marx interpreted. So, and this came in the Greco-Roman civilization to a tremendous peak, and then it collapsed, you see, and again it was built up. Again, this tension was built up, and this is what you mentioned, you come later on to feudalism. You know, but again, this tension grew and grew and grew till it collapsed, and so it goes on and on and on and on, till finally we reach Western Europe in the 70s or late 60s. But there, I think if you later on have some questions, we can have more details. Only I wanted to add, it's not only theory, but Marx proved this from the historical facts that you learned in your high school books. Is it lit?
Fine. Yeah, I'm ready to go.
you have brought it up to a great flame. All right, now, a little bit on Leninism. There is really a great deal that Lenin added to this. My personal feeling is that Lenin was wrong in a couple of things that he said Marx taught. The primary idea which Lenin emphasized was the revolution must be violent. Now, the important point in Marx, and Henning will talk a bit about Hegel tomorrow, and Hegel thought he had grasped the way history goes, the basic principle in nature that explains how history goes. So the emphasis is on natural, inevitable. It's as inevitable as the laws of physics, which today we don't think are so inevitable, but that's another topic. But it is inexorable. It must happen. There will be a revolution after capitalism, and communism is the wave of the future. That's what the next revolution is going to be. And if it is done in a certain kind of way, it will end all revolutions. There won't be any more after that. Now, Lenin is at the point where there is an explicit effort to bring about a revolution. By means of human means, to assist nature in making the next revolution, to get into communism. And Lenin argued, it must be violent. Now, violent means it must be unnatural. See? You must do something. And this is a basic weakness in the Leninist approach. If this is inevitable, if it is natural, if it will happen, you don't have to force it. You don't have to make it happen. It will happen. It will occur in natural kinds of ways. Granted that when the wheel turns, there's suffering and problems and chaos for a while and so on, as the wheel rights itself, because it never moves this smoothly, but it kind of goes like this and it teeters back and forth and it shakes and everything, see, until it settles down and straightens out, gets its equilibrium again. Lenin said, it must be violent. We must bring it about by violence. We must sabotage the stabilizing structures of the current regime to make the wheel turn. It's as though you had a rock balanced up on the side of a mountain, a great boulder, and you pull out the supports and you undermine it, and then it crashes. You've got to do this. And so Lenin was concerned to argue revolution must be violent or it gets prevented by the reactionaries. and then came Mao. Now Mao always and I think still to this day, identifies himself as a Marxist-Leninist. And there's some question as to whether he thinks that revolution inevitably must be violent.
Here I gotta shift to some other notes. For the benefit of the tape recorder, I'm looking up a passage in a book. That sounds tremendous when people listen to that, won't it?
That you're saying the Mao?
Yeah.
The Red Book.
This is Mao's little Red Book. The socialist system will eventually replace the capitalist system. This is an objective law, independent of man's will. The socialist system will eventually replace the capitalist system. This is an objective law of nature, independent of man's will. It's just going to happen. That's the way it is. However much the reactionaries try to hold back the wheel of history, sooner or later the revolution will take place and will inevitably triumph. The wheel will turn. See? Now, what I'm trying to emphasize is understand the word revolution in a nonviolent way. You know, that like a law of physics, it will turn, it will change to this. Well, if this is the case, why do you have to be violent? See? So, all efforts at violent overthrow, wars of national liberation, which Mao invented, are unnatural behaviors, and they do contradict the principle which is being enunciated. So in other words, these are self-contradictory behaviors on the part of the communists. And I think from a propaganda standpoint, we have tended not to exploit this enough in arguing against this kind of approach. All right, now that's directly from Mao. I should make a few comments about this book. I happen to have one which is 1966 printing. I don't know how it got in the United States, but I bought it at Loyola University in Chicago bookstore, where it was openly on sale. I bought it about 5-6 years ago. Recently, I saw a 1972 edition, and it's identical, and it hasn't been changed one bit. They're still selling it for a dollar, and from a printing standpoint and so on, it's a bargain. But this is a book which more people ought to know about, because, you know, this is the Bible of most of the world. As I mentioned before, there are probably more than 1 billion readers of this book. And if we're going to deal with this kind of an approach to life and this kind of approach to history, we better know what they believe in, or we aren't going to be able to combat it at all. So, Mao Zedong himself was born in the early 1890s. He was a revolutionary already in the early 1920s. He and some of his friends were products of the Sun Yat-sen revolution in China, which brought about at least what was hoped to be a republican form of government under Dr. Sun Yat-sen, and got rid of the monarchistic groups. And Chou Enlai, who right now appears to be the successor for Mao when Mao dies, was a graduate of the military college in China, where the commandant was Chiang Kai-shek. So there are relationships, and for a number of years they cooperated with one another in a common effort to stabilize China, get China on a good, stable political footing and economic footing, and in a common battle against the Japanese who had invaded Manchuria. Today, he was not particularly well known in China until after World War II. He is today the father figure of the Chinese Revolution, even as Lenin is in Russia. The Red Book is a collection of little quotations from various speeches and writings of Mao Zedong, and they function sort of like little aphorisms or little pieces of advice.
I missed you. Did you say Zhou Enlai is the father figure, or Mao?
No, Mao Zedong is. Okay. Mao Zedong is, yeah.
I didn't get your translation.
No, Cho En Lai, he's the father figure, the wisdom figure. Cho En Lai apparently is the primary mover today in China. Right. But Mao, he doesn't do anything without clearance from Mao, but Mao is, you know, is sort of like the authority figure, the god figure in Chinese Communist society. So the book functions sort of like wisdom literature. And you go to the book to get inspiration on what to do to solve your problems. And it's fascinating. I had some material I was going to bring along. And I had some material I was going to bring along to illustrate this. Came to our college about a month ago. And the purchasing agent, who's an ex-Air Force man, knew that I was coming out here to talk to you, and he said, hey, this stuff came from the China Book Press in New York, and I don't think anybody ordered it, so why don't you take it? So I took it, and I was all set to show you this stuff. And then about 2 days later, he came to me, and he said, the library ordered it. So I had to turn it over to the library. But anyway, there was some little storybooks for children about problems that arose, like trying to grow new wheat in a commune, and they couldn't solve their problem until they went to the little red book, and Chairman Mao had said so and so, and this then gave them inspiration to solve their problem, thanks be to Comrade Mao. You know, that's the way it operates. I've got a copy of the Peking Review, which is one of their leading export publications. This one's lead article happens to be on the meeting with Dr. Kissinger and Chairman Mao before President Nixon went to China. And there's some other articles in here, and every once in a while they'll say, Chairman Mao said so and so, and therefore we are doing such and such, and Chairman Mao's quotes are always in very heavy print. And so that's the role that it is playing there. It is also playing somewhat the same kind of role in Western Europe, as Hennig will tell you about next time, where the radical students all have a copy of the Little Red Book in their language, and it's being printed at a fantastic rate in all kinds of languages, and it serves as the sort of Bible for revolution. The quotes which are in it date from 1929 to 1964, and they are listed under 33 different head topics. It's not written in an organized kind of way, but there's a little quotes on various kinds of subjects. Some of them are very well known, like the one saying, diplomacy begins with the end of a pistol, and politics is warfare by another means, you know, and warfare is politics by another means. You operate with political devices to achieve your goals, and if they don't work, then you've got to engage in warfare until you get the obstacles out of the way so that you can then go back to politics to achieve the goals that you have in mind. So on. And of course, I suppose among us, the most famous quote from the Little Red Book is, the United States is a paper tiger. Okay, well, I'll give you more quotes from the Little Red Book next time. But how does Mao's communism differ from Lenin and from Marx? Number one, Mao is, strange as it may seem, Mao is a humanist. He believes in the capacity of mankind to survive and to surmount his problems. And Marx and Lenin both, I think, tended to reflect more a Western kind of intellect, which we have tended not to be that sensitive to. We have tended to feel that structures solve problems. Not human beings, but that structures solve problems. Chinese kind of approach is people solve problems. You are in the wilderness with your village hamlet, and you need a connection with civilization in order to get foodstuffs into you. So you get 700 people to get together, and they start cutting down trees, and they start gathering boulders from all over the countryside, and you build your road.
and maybe it takes you 5 years, but you build your 5 miles of road to the nearest rail station and so on. So people solve problems. In the United States, we hire a corporation and it comes and paves a road for us. See? Now that's the difference in the intellect. Now this is reflected also in Marxian communism and Lenin communism. You solve problems by creating a different kind of structure. You revise the economy and the social structure, and the problems solve themselves. With Mao, you do it with people. And people solve problems, not structures and relationships. Number two, I mentioned this already. Mao is much more a consistent pure theorist. Revolution is going to happen, regardless of what we do. It is inevitable. I suppose to some extent this is more apparent in Mao than in Lenin, for instance, because there's a certain strange streak of fatalism in the Chinese mentality. Things are going to turn out the way they're going to. See, yin and yang. This is the way it goes. There's not really much you can do about it, but man will survive. And so whatever will be, will be. And so you mind your own business and do your job and don't worry about what's going to happen. See, so there's a certain element of that sort of thing. This is why, and this is particularly important for Christian missionary activity, there is a sort of indifference to religion. See, because religion concerns itself with the ultimates of life, with ways whereby life can be surmounted and lived out in richness. And if you believe that, well, you know, the only thing you can do is the everyday practical kind of stuff. Well, there's a kind of a feeling here that there's a sort of a super something or other that controls the whole business. But you really have very little to do with it. See, and your relationships are down here with one another. And so there's a kind of an indifference about it. I had a chat about a month ago with some of our Chinese students to see what they knew about what was going on in mainland China. And they said, well, most people are just, they're religious. But they're religious in the vaguest sort of way. Yeah, they believe that God exists. And they really are, and that he's got something to do with them, but they really aren't too concerned about it. And they're in favor of God. They don't disapprove of people being religious or, you know, or being Christian or something like that. But they're pretty much indifferent to the whole business. And what they're concerned about is practical survival, getting ahead of fitting in well in the social community. And they tend not to be, and I'll use a term that's broader than religion, they tend not to be particularly metaphysical about it, like, for instance, the Indian people are. They're not particularly metaphysical. Buddhism didn't succeed in China. Taoism, which is about as close as they come to being metaphysical.
What do you mean by metaphysical?
Looking beyond the concrete to find the meaning of existence, to ultimate principles or something beyond the tangible. To explain the tangible in terms of the intangible, or to explain the material in terms of the conceptual. See? A God whom you cannot see or feel or touch or anything like that controls everything that is. See? They're not interested in that sort of thing. It doesn't fit their mentality. This is one reason why probably Mao was able to be successful with communism in China to the extent that he has been, where all previous foreign attempts to import a foreign ideology or a foreign way of doing things has not succeeded. And communism is a
West German importer and worked out in England thought. Marx came from Germany, spent some time in France, lived his final years in England and died there. And it's Western European thinking put in an Oriental context and has succeeded remarkably well. Now, to what extent it's believed by people, we don't know. We do know that Nazism seemed to have pervaded Germany and World War II was over and it was gone. See, it didn't last. Maybe the same thing with communism in China, but at this point we can't tell. All right, number two. Another problem, from a purely theoretic standpoint, with Marx's notion of communism is that this dialectic, once started, will come to an end. That when you come to the communist, the pure communist society, there will be no more classes, there will be no more oppressor and oppressed, there will be equalization of resources according to a certain principle, and everything is going to go fine and there'll be no more disruptions. Well, from a purely theoretic standpoint, that's lousy theory. It's much better theory to say the dialectic continues infinitely. And that's what Mao says. Now Mao says, don't believe that when the communist society has come into being, that that will be the end of revolutions. There will continue to need to be revolutions. Why? I mentioned before, you get stabilized like this, and maybe this gets pretty monotonous. People get bored with it. Now, Mao says, every time that wheel turned, there was progress. Progress in a positive sense. This kind of society was better than this one. See, this society is better than the previous one was. All right, so now we turn from capitalism to communism, and there we are. There are more revolutions possible. What will cause the revolution under communist society? The intellectuals, the thinking people. They will show ways whereby the society like this is less satisfactory for human beings than this. And so consequently, anytime we start getting set in our ways and contented with the way things are and the way things are going, we've got to have a revolution. And this is what explains the Red Guard Revolution in China. People were getting set in their ways. They were content. China was getting ahead. Things were going along, and Mao wrecked the whole thing. He says, we got to wreck it because something better will come out of it than what we had. And so there have to be periodic revolutions in order to keep society advancing and becoming better and better. So even under communism, there will be revolutions. Now that's much better theory from a purely theoretic standpoint than the Russian variety. It's also much more compatible, particularly to intellectuals, because it gives the intellectuals a particularly good role in a society. And so the intellectuals will support this kind of an approach where they wouldn't support the Russian kind of approach where everybody was a proletarian. The guys that weren't against it were against this were the intellectuals and the rich guys. Why should they be a proletarian? They were top dogs. Now they'd be just like everybody else. Mm-hmm.
But does he agree with the theory of violence to force this revolution? From what you said, he did. He instigated the Red Guard movement.
Is this the same theory that Lenin had here?
I mean, would he identify with Lenin that you got to help along?
What Lenin said was that the movement from capitalism to communism must be violent.
Okay.
Now, what Mao says is that there will be a kind of natural ferment of people who will get better ideas than the ideas you've got now. And so, periodically, there must be a revolution, even when you've got communism.
Okay, what I'm saying is, would he believe in forcing this refinement of communism, like the initiation of the Red Guard? People are getting sick,
yeah.
So he stirs them up deliberately.
Yeah, now that, in a sense, it's not... Let me limit violent to necessary to kill people. See, now the Red Guard uprising was not violent in that sense. But he shook up society.
Well, I misunderstood what I read in the newspaper, because I understood that they really, like leaders in the villages and so forth, the Red Guard came in and they trumped up charges against them and let them out in the public square, and first thing you know, they were bit to dust.
No, as far as the latest things that we've heard, this was exaggerated. I don't want to say that nobody got killed or anything like that. The last things that I've read, and I would not claim to be a China expert by any stretch of the imagination, the latest things that have been coming out is that the Red Guard Revolution was much less violent than was reported. Now, it did do a lot. It really disrupted the social fabric, particularly the universities.
Yeah.
For instance, the universities changed from traditional universities in the largely European model to, all right, so I don't care whether you got a PhD or not. For the next 6 months, you're going to go out and hoe corn. See, you got to get back in touch with the people. And they closed down the universities for 6 months, 9 months. They have a setup now where you get assigned to some commune to go out and work, to keep you in touch with reality, so you don't go off on cloud nine. It's not totally bad. What's difficult about it is they say, all right, now you will go to commune so-and-so, and your wife will go to commune so-and-so, which is 1,000 miles away, and you'll be there for 2 years, and your kids are going so-and-so. And they've done this sort of thing, which is very difficult for people to tolerate.
Okay.
But the Red Guards were used as a disruptive influence to break up certain structures which were beginning to form. Now, there's some reason to believe that Mao was beginning to feel that the army was getting too powerful, because the regional army commanders were like the network by which he held the country together. And it may well be that he felt they were getting too strong, so he messed up the situation, and we start putting things back together again and see if we come up with something better than we got.